Next up on This Week in Law, Christian Audie joins me and Matt Curtis. I'm Denise Howell. 1 week into the GDPR, we're going to look at what enforcement actions are pending already, how people are dealing with compliance, how the law can be enforced against U.S. companies with no presence in the EU, and much more as we try and unravel the complexities of the GDPR. Christian is also a specialist in blockchain technologies, and we're going to discuss regulating ICOs and what you can do with the blockchain anyway, that and AIs that send you helpful emails, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Matt Curtis, and Mike Keyes. Episode 424, recorded June 1st, 2018. Stick to Excel. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm very excited you're all here with us because I'm very excited about our guest. First-time guest to TWiL is Christian Audie. And Christian is a partner at Much Shellist in Chicago and a good friend of our good friend, Evan Brown, who is also a partner there. Hi, Christian. Great to have you.
Hi. Thank you very much. It's great to be here, Denise.
Christian is a partner there who works a lot on privacy compliance, data breaches. He's a member of the firm's blockchain technologies team, and he's also a blogger. He has a blog at distributedcounsel.com. So it sounds like you're keeping quite busy these days, Christian.
I am indeed. I haven't actually updated that blog in almost a month now because I've just been negligent, but I've also a lot's been going on with GDPR and other stuff. So yes, certainly busy these days.
It has indeed. And we're waiting to be joined by one of my co-hosts, Matt Curtis, who is hoping to jump in a little later on in the show. So don't be surprised when all of a sudden we go from two to three on this episode of This Week in Law. And since we were not recording last week on May 25th, we've gotten to watch the fallout this entire week of the implementation of the GDPR. So I think we will go ahead and start with the GDPR and our privacy stories. So big week, Christian. Lots to watch and think about as the GDPR goes into effect, has gone into effect. You and I and probably everyone still watching and listening are probably still getting emails that various privacy policies have been updated, even if companies didn't manage to get their updates done by the 25th. That doesn't mean that they're not still going to push them out when and as they're available.
Absolutely.
So that is probably the most visible thing that your average person has been seeing about the GDPR is this flurry of updates to people's privacy policies. And a lot of fear, I think, on the part of private companies, particularly smaller ones, and public companies to boot, of what they need to do in order to not run afoul of these new regulations. And I think what most companies and their executives are concerned about are the fines that are possible. 4% of, is it global revenue?
Yes, 4% of revenue or 20 million euros, whichever is higher.
Right. But one thing that it's good to remember about the GDPR is in addition to its incredibly scary fines, possibly company debilitating fines, it has many other enforcement mechanisms that the regulators can apply should they wish. Can you speak to that for a moment?
Sure. They can, They can have lesser fines. They can require some sort of affirmative conduct. They can also, and what I think is really very interesting, they can also make you sort of stop processing data or stop processing certain data sets. And depending on the type of company you are, that could in fact be more ruinous than a fine. You know, you can imagine somebody telling Facebook that they just can't process personal data in the EU anymore. That's way more than 20 million euros, and it may even be more than 4% of their revenue. And so I think that's, you know, certainly why you've seen from the larger companies especially, you've seen such a proactive approach in terms of getting ready for this. Mm-hmm. You know, with respect to the smaller companies, I do think, you know, it's important to have some perspective about this. This law has to be enforced by a bureaucracy, a different one in each one of the member states, and they're starting new too. You know, I mean, they've got 1 week behind them right now. They probably haven't developed a complete regulatory philosophy yet. They may not be fully staffed yet. They may not be fully funded yet. And they're learning too in a very real sense. And so, you know, while it is certainly important to be compliant and certainly to be compliant in all your public facing facets, whether that's on the website, whether that's with counterparties and vendors, you know, bear in mind that what I thought was going to happen largely has, and that's you haven't seen a whole lot of regulatory action in the early days because it's really more of a well, let's see what we have here.
Right. But folks who were locked and loaded to be private citizens seeking enforcement of the GDPR have gone ahead and forged into the breach. Tell us about that.
Sure. So you've got I think probably the most prominent example would be Schrems. Max Schrems has brought a lawsuit, I think within hours of the law going effective, against Facebook and against, I think it was the other one was Google, alleging essentially that it was a forced consent, that the decision to either consent to the processing of your personal data in certain ways by Google and or Facebook, or simply not use them, is coercive, which is a very interesting idea. You know, Mr. Schrems, of course, is the same person who got the US EU safe harbor invalidated some time ago in 2013, and he's made a name for himself as a privacy advocate ever since. The underlying philosophy animating this idea is very interesting, and it sort of relies on the premise that, you know, going without Facebook or going without Google is not really an alternative in modern society, and treats them a little bit like utilities, right? Mm-hmm. That you can't just say, no, you won't service me anymore, Google, or no, you won't service me anymore, Facebook, because I really need this and I've been on this platform for a very long time and it has enormous value to me. It'll be very interesting to see. I mean, obviously, it's in its very initial stages. It'll be interesting to see how much currency that argument has.
It will be interesting. It's funny, Evan, years ago, when he was still co-hosting the show with me, terminated his Facebook account, like way ahead of the rush to terminate your Facebook account in the wake of Cambridge Analytica, for various reasons. And you know, it was convincing me and our listeners at the time that, yeah, it's not a utility. I'm fine without Facebook.
Right, right. And, do you have one? I've never been on Facebook in my life.
Oh,
I love
never,
Twitter.
So you're, yeah. That's okay. I've been a longtime Facebook user, but definitely in the wake of Cambridge Analytica, it feels like we have a quote from Cisco's Michelle Dennehy in one of the articles in our rundown this week, where she talks about businesses storing data that they don't necessarily need to have on hand, and that the GDPR is making them rethink that. Her point was that storage was cheap and managing or, you know, using data has a high upside, but now it has a high downside as well. And she says it's kind of like that show Hoarders. It's smelly in there.
Yes.
I've kind of felt like since Cambridge Analytica, it's kind of smelly over in the Facebook universe, and I haven't been there much lately, and have definitely been reacquainting myself with Twitter, which I have not, which I'm enjoying, and I'm not feeling like I'm missing Facebook all that much. Right. So, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see. There were a flurry of articles yesterday about just basically confirming if you have teenagers or young people in your life, you already know that they're not using Facebook. And a bunch of articles came out yesterday with data around that. Of course, they are using Instagram, which Facebook owns. So 6 to 1, half dozen the other, maybe. But I think they're, you know, definitely in a situation where they're going to have to get out in front of this, or they're not going to get out in front of it, and they're going to be way behind it. And as you said, you know, the first lawsuits or first compliance actions, I guess, under GDPR have definitely targeted Facebook. And I think they're going to be, for, you know, when the regulators start to take their steps, Facebook and Google are definitely going to be in those crosshairs as well. Do you agree?
Yeah, I certainly do. And it'll be interesting to see sort of what kind of regulatory approach they take. I would imagine, you know, there's kind of two ways you can do it if you're a regulator. And this also translates to what we're seeing in blockchain. One way is you can just go after the big guys right away. And you can say, this is what this law is really about. We're going to fight this battle. We're going to make you more compliant. We're going to make sure that we're enforcing our law 100% against you, Google, against you, Facebook. The other approach that you could take is maybe go after a smaller but flagrant violator and obtain some decent precedent. And then only then sort of attack the larger entity. And I'll be looking particularly at the Irish regulator in this regard, because Ireland is likely to be, I think, at least as I understand the law, the lead supervisory authority for both Facebook and Google, given that Facebook and Google's main establishments are located there for tax reasons. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see the approach that they take. The SEC and other regulators on blockchain have taken the latter approach. Right, they haven't gone after any of the big exchanges or GDAX or Gemini or anything like that. They've gone after these small, sort of obvious frauds, perhaps in an effort to establish some favorable case law before they go after bigger entities. Or maybe they're not going to do it at all.
The couple of questions that I've been getting the most about GDPR, of course, you know, everyone is full of questions about all aspects of it, but the ones that seem to be forefront in people's minds, companies' minds, are, I think, coming my way through people and representatives of entities who are not Facebook and Google and cannot afford the, you know, huge compliance infrastructure that needs to be in place if you're going to be processing the data of EU residents. So one thing that seems to be a trend is people saying, making their sites unavailable, at least temporarily, to users in the EU. And some, I think, making their sites completely unavailable, just saying, we don't want any part of managing the data of EU users because it's too complicated and the downsides are too huge. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, it's an unfortunate reaction, and it is in some sense an understandable reaction. I think it's actually hard to execute on that. You know, just geofencing your website off may not be enough. You may have subsidiaries or other people who are really purposefully offering goods or services to EU data subjects. Nonetheless, you may still be processing data because of relationships with counterparties who are sending you personal data. So you're getting it in your capacity as a processor. But I think it underscores the breadth and the difficulty associated with complying with this law. The fact that people are willing to literally shut out the European market instead of undertake the compliance task perhaps suggests that we're asking a little bit too much, especially of smaller companies. And you know, there may be an unintended consequence here too, Denise, in the sense that, you know, it is very easy for a Google, a Facebook, whoever, you know, large entities to hire a bunch of guys like me and comply, you know, or come close. It is much more difficult for a startup or for a small organization that may have 5 or 10% of their sales in Europe to jump through all of these hurdles and still be profitable at the end of the year. You know, and unfortunately, there isn't the sort of, you know, the Article 30 of GDPR, for example, only applies to entities that have over 250 employees. But there isn't a lot of that in GDPR. It basically applies almost to everybody. And, yeah, I think it's a problem with the law.
Yeah, it's definitely going to lead to some interesting results. We have a piece in our rundown for today. And folks, I encourage you to read what we have read to get ready for the show today. If you go over to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, that's where I aggregate everything by episode number. So we're episode 424 today. And there's a piece from pointer.org that talks about news organizations, because that's what Pointer is. But the things that are being expressed there certainly apply to other small organizations, but they highlight a couple of small local media companies. One is WRAL, and they did the math and decided that EU residents accounted for about 2% of their total visitors recently, and that, you know, just from a cost-benefit standpoint, blocking out 2% of their users was the most prudent thing to do rather than try and do all the compliance steps, or at least try and do them right away. I think that they and others have kind of taken the approach that we're going to block them until we feel very comfortable that we've taken all the steps that we need to make sure we're not running afoul of this law. So I could definitely see other businesses doing that. I wanted to drill a little deeper on the term that you've used and the term that is so important under the GDPR, data subject. Mm-hmm. There is another piece in the New York Times in our rundown. It's an opinion piece there called Data Subjects of the World Unite that talks about this term and how it's going to operate and the complexities of it, et cetera. And I'm a little confused about all this, and I'm sure that others are too, Christian. One of the points that is made in that piece is that under the new law, you can be a citizen of the United States, a resident of Japan, and a European data subject at the same time. Can you unpack that for me?
It is a very difficult term to understand. And that makes sense. You know, a lot of the early advice I saw in articles was, you know, it's about EU citizens, and it's not, right? If you live in France and you're a Moroccan national and you're a data subject, your data, you know, the data, at least that you communicate in the EU or is subject to GDPR. It doesn't have anything to do with nationality or residency. It has everything to do, and it has everything to do with location, and the location of the subject. Right. And you know, likewise, if you're a French citizen and a French resident, and you find yourself in New York, you know, buying a cheesecake online, that data is not subject to GDPR. The question is, now you provide an email, right? And that email links back to an account that's in France. Does that apply to GDPR? And how would you figure that out? And that's what, you know, and then it becomes exhausting. But, you know, I think that the simplest response is a data subject's somebody that's in the EU. And whether they're a U.S. national or a Japanese national or whatever, it's somebody who's in the EU, is there, and is communicating data.
Yeah, makes my head hurt. One of the other things that seems important, at least for enforcement purposes, if not for how the GDPR is, or, you know, whose data is supposed to be protected, is where the data physically resides. This sort of comes back to the case that we've discussed that went before the Supreme Court, and then Congress stepped in and enacted legislation that sort of resolved the case without the Supreme Court having to issue an opinion, although it may yet do so. I don't know that it's said one way or the other whether it's going to. But this is the case that involves data stored by Microsoft in Ireland that related to a criminal investigation in the U.S. Microsoft declined to turn over the data, and this is what ultimately resulted in this year's Cloud Act.
Right.
So where the data lives has to at least be somewhat relevant, because if you're dealing with EU residents' data and you're keeping that data in the EU, it's going to be much easier to enforce GDPR violations against you, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, especially if they were to say you got to stop processing it, and here it is. Right. Mm-hmm. But there is also enforcement, you know, whether it is through model clauses or through, voluntary agreements such as Privacy Shield, in the U.S. There are mechanisms to get at that data by either data subjects or the supervisory authorities, you know, even here.
Right.
The Cloud Act, that's interesting because it's sort of, at least my understanding of it is, it sort of uses the placement of the data in a foreign jurisdiction as a sword that allows U.S. government to get at it absent a search warrant. I think mm-hmm. I'm understanding this correctly. Absent a search warrant, even if it were here, even if they would have needed one here. And when you send your data to Microsoft or Google or elsewhere, you're not really thinking about, hey, where are your servers, mm-hmm. right? You're really thinking, well, this is Microsoft and I'm storing my data with them and I'm an American, and you think it's going to be all protected. And that just may not be the case. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, though. I think the Cloud Act was just very recently passed. So it's probably early days there.
Right. So that's the second big question I've been seeing from people. The first was, does it make sense that we just block? And the second mm-hmm. is, how are they even going to come after us? We're in the U.S. How does that all work? And the answer to that, at least, it's a complicated answer. Part of what I just said, if you're storing data in the EU and processing EU residents' data, I think it's easier to come after you under their own judicial system, regulatory system, etc. But say you're not storing any data in the EU. All your servers are here in the US. You're headquartered here in the US. You have no physical presence in the EU whatsoever. Can they still come after you? Yes. Because we honor each other's judgments. Countries have agreements. There's this principle called comity, mm-hmm. not comedy. It's with a T. That means that if there's a valid judgment in one country and you bring it to another country, you take it to the courts, our courts will look at that and go, yeah, that looks like a valid judgment to me. There is some sort of gatekeeping function that our courts have, and they can refuse to enforce. But by and large, you know, if it's a judgment or a legal action of a foreign entity with authority and jurisdiction, I guess that could be a thorn in the process. Then our courts will enforce them. Do you want to speak a little bit more to enforcing in the United States against U.S. non-EU entities?
Well, yeah, what you've said is absolutely correct. And as a practical matter, EU judgments, generally speaking, I think I could say are going to be enforced by U.S. courts. The jurisdictional question is especially interesting here, because mm-hmm. When you're in the hypothetical that you're presenting, when you're sitting in the U.S. and maybe availing yourself of multiple jurisdictions in the EU, the question then becomes, well, which one's going to be the lead authority? Which one actually has authority to do things? And this is going to be super meaningful eventually, because they're going to develop different regulatory philosophies. One's going to say, no, I'm going to be a little bit more standoffish and not spend a lot of money. The other's going to say, I'm going to fine as many people as I can, right? I mean, different jurisdictions act in different ways. And, you know, threshold jurisdictional arguments about the ability of a supervisory authority to render the judgment or impose the fine in the first place are the sorts of arguments that might be successful back here in the States when they try to domesticate a judgment. But you're, by and large, that's you're it's exactly as you say. You know, they're going to come to the U.S. They're going to try to domesticate the judgment and enforce it here. And, you know, we'll see whether or not that is ultimately successful. It is often expressed to me that, you know, this is who are these guys to be basically imposing a worldwide privacy law? Mm-hmm. And my response is always, you know, this is sort of the European privacy law revenge for the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, you know, or which, you know, is, you know, a bribe is paid in Bulgaria and suddenly you find yourself in the Southern District of New York talking about it, you know, and it's like, how did that happen? But it is going to be interesting once they do try to enforce it, and it'll be interesting to see what approach we take both in the court system now and from a legislative perspective in reaction to this.
Yeah, it certainly will be interesting. Hey, I want to welcome to the show Matt Curtis. He has joined us. Hi, Matt.
Hi, sorry for being late. I switched over to Bay Area time this week, and I got a little lost on the time tracking, so I apologize.
No worries. Yeah, you're used to doing the show on Central Time, as Christian
I was looking for 2 o'clock, and 11 came much earlier.
It does that. Christian, Matt, Christian.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Matt, if you're just meeting Matt for the first time, is a law student at Notre Dame and an entrepreneur newly relocated to the Bay Area here in California. How's it going, Matt? How's your...
Things are good. We're getting settled in, and, you know, it's been nice to be with my business partner all week and working hard and just getting things rolling.
That's wonderful. Congratulations. And glad to have you in the Pacific time zone for a change. We hope yeah. We keep you here a while.
Yeah, Victor noticed that I was even a little bit had color because I can go outside and walk around.
Yes.
And it's sunny.
This is true. You have a rosy glow. Getting.
Yeah. It's not just the stairs I had to walk up.
Good. Well, I'm glad California seems to suit you. We've been talking about the GDPR. We've been covering early private enforcement actions that have been instituted. We've been talking about enforcing against U.S. entities that don't have any other ties to the EU. We've been talking about whether small companies or maybe even larger ones might make the determination that enough of their business is not located in the EU, that they would just take the step of blocking EU residents and not processing their data to be not subject to the law. There's so much more we could discuss in this first week of the GDPR being in effect. Have you had any questions or observations, Matt, over the last week? We've got Christian on board, and this is definitely his area of practice.
Yeah, I think that the really interesting question is, so if someone is in the United States, their IP address is in the United States, and so they enter an address, so a European citizen who's living in San Francisco, and if they enter an address that says that they're from San Francisco, and there's no information given that they're a foreign citizen, like, what's the legal obligation then? If you don't know, if you shouldn't have known that this person is foreign citizen, I think that that's going to be the really interesting question, because in that instance, you know, in the instance that you're getting data from an IP address that's in Europe, okay, you probably should have known. If they tell you that your address is in France, you probably should have known. But in the situation where you shouldn't have known and there's no real basis for you to flag the data and treat it differently, I think that'll be an interesting test case to come down the line.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'd just throw into the mix of that question the whole notion of using VPNs, which lots of people do. that mask yeah. their actual location.
It's tough, and you know the location where you are is important, and I think it's actually more important than your citizenship. You know, so if you're in the EU, even if you're not an EU citizen, you likely are still a data subject. And likewise, if you're a UK expat, you've lived here for the last 5 years, I don't think that GDPR is following you around and your employer, who's just a local shop, suddenly has to comply because it's got personal data of an EU citizen. But it's going to be, you know, at the margins, right, there are a lot of very difficult questions about how much you should know and what you should know. Whether an IP address is even personal information or personal data in all cases, right? Because personal data is attributable to an individual, and certain IP addresses are. My home computer probably is, but others certainly are not, right? My library, like if I go to the local public library and hop on one of those computers, that IP address certainly is not attributable to an individual. These are the vagaries that are really, really difficult to respond to in a vacuum. You know, we have to see how it is enforced. We have to see, you know, how all of these definitions, frankly, are actually applied when the rubber meets the road. And that's been part of the challenge, and I think part of the frustration for a lot of folks in preparing for this law, when there are these ambiguities and we don't know how that's going to be enforced.
Charles in IRC is pointing out something really interesting too, aside from the VPN case. He says a corner case is that IP addresses get traded between ISPs as we're running out of IPv4, and the location of an IP address can change many times, so it's hard to tell for sure where an IP is. An example is Microsoft Azure, which US data centers often appear, I guess they read it as being based in Brazil, because they purchased the Brazilian IPs. So it seems like there's just a lot of complexity to making these judgments under the GDPR that I don't know if, you know, I think we're just early days and none of this has really been fleshed out yet. We can certainly expect to see these kinds of arguments be made in enforcement actions as they begin to percolate out. But it seems like there are a lot of arguments that can be made and a lot of complexity to how this is all going to work. There was an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was just yesterday, about one sort of unintended effect of the GDPR. You would think that it would be the goal of the regulators here to want to encourage a robust, competitive ad marketplace where not everyone is having to place their online ads through Google, but could use other ad brokers because, you know, obviously competition is good for the market. And ideally, I think what they want to have happen is, you know, those really good model corporate citizens who are going to people and having very clear consent documentation, just in time, privacy by design oriented consent mechanisms, etc. So that's great that we want to encourage that. But what this Wall Street Journal article is pointing out is the early effect seems to be that a lot of the ad business is consolidated with Google because their compliance mechanisms are in place, and you know, they're so far out in front of this, and others may be scrambling or just non-compliant, and so it seems to be consolidating power right where, you know, if you want competition to thrive, right where you don't want it. Do you have any thoughts about that, Christian?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an I think it's a very real phenomenon, and I think, you know, it's important to talk about that because, you know, obviously the goal is, as you say, right? The goal is to essentially empower individuals and give them the ability to control their data. And in the service of that, we've imposed a lot of regulations that are so difficult to comply with. People are only trusting the very, very largest entities to do that. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if we've acted in service of that goal. Ultimately, we are where we are. And, you know, I don't know that we'll be having the same conversation a year or two from now. You know, I noticed in some of the other materials on the rundown, there was sort of a one-stop privacy shop. That have been put together by some of the Google team. Hopefully, you know, compliance becomes easier as we get more information and more understanding about the law, and it's not this incredible barrier that it has been thus far. That's typically been the case with other, you know, really kind of broad regulatory regimes. I'm thinking primarily here of HIPAA in the United States, where, you know, everybody thought this was going to be and HIPAA is not easy to comply with. I'm certainly not suggesting that. But, you know, there is a little bit more comfort around the concepts and the ideas now. And, you know, you're not going to be, I guess, afraid to start a pharmacy because of HIPAA. There may be other reasons you want to do that, but it's not HIPAA. And hopefully we get to that point. But right now, I think it's conferred an enormous advantage on the Googles and the Facebooks and the Microsofts and those folks.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up HIPAA because it's sort of I'm pretty hopeful about what the GDPR may accomplish for privacy interests around the world in general. But then when I think about something like HIPAA and what it has accomplished and what it has accomplished, as far as I can tell, aside from I'm not, again, like you, Christian, saying it's easy to comply with. And I assume that having those compliance regulations in place are a good thing. But as far as people understanding what's being done with their data, I think on the user end, what HIPAA has accomplished is a form you have to sign just about every time you go to the doctor, a form that confirms that you've read something you haven't read, and you're signing anyway so you can see your doctor. And, you know, that's about it as far as the public face of HIPAA goes. Right, I'm sure behind the scenes, there's a lot more merit to it. And I wonder, you know, if that's how GDPR is going to be too, that the meaningful consent piece, I guess that's the thrust of the Max Schrems argument, isn't it, Christian?
Yeah, I think that is the thrust of the Max Schrems argument is, you know, I should be receiving the granular ability to control what you see and what you don't and make decisions about the services that you provide. That's the philosophy. And you by making it an all or nothing or close to an all or nothing, you've in essence violated my rights already before I've made a decision. I think you're also right that, you know, there is some chance that GDPR is just going to become, you know, this other check the box sort of thing and something that sits in the back of privacy policies. It'll be interesting. There are these data subject rights, you know, right to be forgotten, which is, of course, a limited right, certainly not an absolute right. It's right to portability, the right to understand and download, you know, all the information that somebody has about you. Right. These are interesting rights that, you know, it depends on how they start being exercised. If people basically ignore it, like your right to get a copy of your electronic medical record in HIPAA, right, which nobody ever uses. If people basically ignore it, this may have all been for have had limited effect, and the only thing that you're really getting is a really, you know, empowered privacy police over there in Europe. But if people are exercising their rights, you know, maybe the dynamic in the bargaining power will change and folks will be able to sort of reassert control of their data, at least in the EU.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. We have a couple of examples in the rundown for today's show of people, of ways that people thinking about privacy are trying to make it easier for people to exercise their rights. There's a fellow named Don Marti, who is part of the VRM, Virtual Rights Management, vendor relationship management, sorry, not virtual rights management. He's part of that community. He has something on GitHub, which he calls a GDPR letter, a template for a letter to, he specifically concerned with opting out of Facebook custom audiences. But in any event, he's got a model letter. Then I'm sure others will have model letters as well. That is the individual demand objecting to various processing of personal data, revoking any previous consents that may have been granted, and asking for confirmation that the company has ceased processing of the data. There's another piece that's been up for more than a year on LinkedIn called the Nightmare Letter, a subject access request under GDPR by Konstantin Karbaliotis. He is a privacy-related person, and he has a similar kind of letter, writing to a company, verifying his identity, asking the company to confirm whether his personal data is being processed, what they're doing with the data, where the data is stored physically, asking for a copy of the data, asking for the specific uses of the data, and on and on. So, you know, this I think is a fringe portion of the public, and that most people won't know, or even if they are aware that these templates exist, they won't bother to make use of them, is just my guess. But what do you think, Christian? Could there be a groundswell of both awareness and use of this kind of request?
I think it depends on where we're talking about. I think that there is certainly in Europe, there is much more interest in privacy by individuals. And we say that we're interested here, but we also, you know, sign away basically all of our rights for free email. And so, you know, I think that people say that they're very interested in their personal privacy in the abstract, but then when it comes time to do all those opt-outs and to, you know, attack all those issues and send all those letters, some do and some don't. I think that there is a lot more awareness now though, than there ever has been around these issues because of Cambridge Analytica, because of some of the other really more you know, gratuitous uses of information that have caused people to sit up and take notice. So, you know, we'll see. I think the bottom line answer is I think there's a better chance of it in Europe than there would be here, but we may nevertheless see it here too.
Right. It reminds me a little bit of when Pokemon Go came out, and there was a good deal of public awareness around the fact that there was a mandatory arbitration clause in the terms of service that could be opted out of. And you know, there was a good deal of online discourse about here's how you opt out, and easy to do, send this email and you're done. But I'd be really curious to know how many people actually did it. Of course I did, and did so on behalf of family members who were playing the game. But you know, who knows how many people really pay attention to that kind of thing. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I'm skeptical of the interest that people actually have in their own data. I think that, like, you know, maybe that's why you need laws to protect them, because they're not actually, you know, you're not concerned while you're doing things, but you're concerned in the abstract or concerned in the long run. And those are like legitimate concerns that you don't actually operationalize on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, I think it's, I think it'll, you know, we'll tell. It seems like, you know, I can't imagine having a team of like a company with 10 people who started this 6 months ago. And, you know, could you imagine getting 100 of those letters a week and like trying to respond to it while you're trying to, like, if you're Google, it's fine, right? Because you're Google and you can, you know, if you need $100 million of attorneys to go answer these things, that's fine. But if you started a company 6 months ago and now you have to answer all these letters of data and you know, go through and clean all your data and turn off this person and turn on this person, that'd be terrible. Like, I think that there's cost and benefits. You hope that the long-term costs, right? There's always short-term costs in putting in a new program. You hope that the long-term costs are not prohibitive.
Right. I don't want to get into, you know, privileged communications with your counsel or anything, Matt, but you are at the beginning of a startup company with venture funding, and this making these decisions has to be on your management team's radar. Do you have any insights you can share from that perspective?
Yes, they're very much on our radar. I can't go into it like specifically.
Yeah, no, just that, you know, I'm sure for a
it
small.
It is on the top of the list.
Yeah, I'm sure for a small company, it's particularly perplexing how to make strategic decisions that make the most sense. You mentioned, Christian, the bubbling up, you know, various consequences that maybe the EU regulators hadn't thought of. We talked about consolidating power, advertising power in big players. Another consequence you mentioned earlier, Christian, is people rushing into the breach to help with compliance for companies large and small. Two former folks on Google's legal staff, former folks from the legal staff, have launched something called the Privacy Compliance Hub, which is designed to take organizations through their data obligations in a step-by-step way, and also to give them a paper trail so that they can say, you know, if they are being investigated, they have a timeline and actual documentation. We did this. We've done this, you know, all geared toward making sure that they're on the right side of any compliance actions. It is not cheap, especially for a small company. This was written up by a UK news organization. So the dollars they cite are in pounds, or the money they cite is in pounds. £15,000 is the upfront fee to subscribe to the hub, with a £2,000 annual fee for the updates. The last time I checked pound to dollar conversions, you know, I generally just double to make things easy, but I'm sure that's not quite right. But so you can, somewhere upwards of $20,000 is what you're going to pay up front, and somewhere upwards of $3,000 is what you're going to pay annually for your updates. So I think it's a great idea. And if you look at their site, you know, they're definitely thinking about the right things. And I think this could be a good investment for the right company. And they, you know, from the standpoint of a lawyer who does this, Christian, do you feel like there's an opening for someone to come in and get really hands-on with the company the way that this Privacy Compliance Hub means to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, here's just one example is something we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, you mm-hmm. got too much data, right? One of the things that people suddenly realize is I haven't been deleting anything, and I thought all of this data was an asset, and I've now decided that it's a liability. And mm-hmm. and normally people arrive at this conclusion in a couple of different ways. The first is that they get sued in litigation and have a bunch of emails that they wish they deleted. And the other is they suffer a data breach, and they lose this data, and then they have to report it to all of these people that with whom they have not done business in many, many years. Right. Mm-hmm. And then they get a data retention policy at that point. But this is another opportunity, you know, to say, okay, you need a data retention policy. You need to do something. You need to figure out how long you should be keeping emails, what's required mm-hmm. by your regulations, and what's not. And so this is absolutely an opportunity to dig in with clients and address not just GDPR compliance, but your data privacy and security compliance, which is a broader issue. You know, that said, it all sounds very expensive, right? And you know, part of what this Privacy and Compliance Hub is trying to attack is that it's mm-hmm. it's saying here's a fixed number, and you're going to be compliant. Now I haven't looked at what they've done, you know, in any detail, so I'm certainly not prepared to say that what they're doing is right. But you know, assuming that it is, that's very attractive. And I think as a compliance attorney, as a privacy attorney, you know, part of my job for my clients is to make sure that they're getting really good value, and that's, you know, that's not always an hourly rate, right? That sometimes that's an alternative fee arrangement. Sometimes that's doing other things, so that, you know, you're working collaboratively with them, and because it's tough, and it's a big issue, and it's an issue that affects small companies as well as large companies. And you want to be able to work with them in a way that's going to make sense and in a way that's going to actually provide value.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good idea. I mean, I haven't looked at, obviously, what they're actually offering, but I think, you know, conceptually it makes a lot of sense.
It does. I guess just sort of tangentially, it has me thinking too, the two heads of the company are lawyers doesn't mean everybody else is, or, you know, how you handle the fact that they do seem to be providing legal guidance and advice here. And we have regulations in this country about, you know, being licensed to do that and all. So, and what sort of obligations that you have to, you know, your own data management, et cetera, your confidentiality duties to your clients, et cetera, et cetera. So, it does seem like they're in a strange situation where they could get challenged on that front, but I think it's an incredibly useful looking service. And I do think that others will forge into this breach as well. Let's see, before we stop talking about privacy related stuff, which we have done for most of the show today, I just wanted to highlight a couple of things. I'm having a privacy policy polyamory, I guess. I have a couple of, you know, just to make you happy about reading privacy policies, which nobody ever is, particularly with the onslaught of emails everyone has been getting lately, that folks' policies have been updated.
I still love them, Denise. I still love them.
Yes. It takes a special breed.
Yeah.
Of which at least two of us here are part of. I don't know, Matt, would you say you love reading privacy policies?
No, I'm not part of that breed.
You're a sane person. Here's one from writershq.co.uk that starts with it's their privacy policy, and it starts with the words, "Wow, has anyone ever read one of these?" it's an actual functioning privacy policy, but it's written in language that is friendly and humorous and it's a nice, I think, refreshing breath of air in this world. There's a whole section called TLDR. We're a tiny, overstretched business, and we don't have the time or energy to do anything nefarious with your data. It's not that we're not evil. We're as corruptible as anyone. We're just too tired to think of a malevolent plot to steal your identity, et cetera. We collect and store the info we need to provide you with the service you buy from us. We occasionally stalk you via Facebook advertising. That's really it. You know, I mean, they're being a little flip here, and it could be that, you know, the stocky Facebook advertising might require more discussion and disclosure, but it's kind of a cool little privacy policy. And the other thing I just wanted to highlight came my way via Victor on the board in the studio, which was near and dear to my heart, and I'm sure will be a favorite of our listeners and viewers. Somebody doctored up the opening crawl of the Star Wars credits to become an update to the global privacy terms of, in this case, episode 8, The Last Jedi. Your trust is important to us, etc. So thank you for that, Victor. That Rian Johnson on Twitter.
I think I saw an app with that essentially read the GDPR to you to put you to sleep.
Oh, yes. So I've had so many people send that to me. It's a meditation app.
Yeah.
And it literally will just read you the GDPR. And folks who have used it say, yep, puts you right out.
Puts you right out. Works like a charm.
Yes. In my case, I don't know that it would be that calming. I think I would be scratching my head and asking questions. All right. So let us move on. Unless, let me just ask you to, if there's anything that we that you would have liked us to discuss about the GDPR or privacy compliance in general in today's world, before we move on. Christian, anything else you want to add?
I think we've covered the waterfront. No, I think we're
okay. Matt, final thoughts?
Yeah, just that, you know, legal clarity is going to be what ultimately lowers the cost of compliance, and it's just going to take a while, especially you're talking international, you're talking comedy, which is not always as straightforward as it seems, and then you're talking, you know, the American Events Act was just upheld constitutionally after 5 years in patent law. So, like, you know, things take a while to get through the courts, and this is going to be a while before the cost of compliance gets down. And probably the best thing to do is to be over compliant and deal with it from that perspective. So,
yeah, that's an excellent
big change,
point.
And that's the way it goes.
Yeah, and some of this is going to be a learn by doing exercise for small and for large organizations. I mean, you know. Right to be forgotten, for example. You could probably go comb through your organization and all of your data backup providers and so on and figure out a way to actually exercise this right. Or you can get your first request and figure it out by learning by doing. And I think that, you know, that's just one example of, you know, this is going to be an experiential process. You can plan and you can put policies in place, but until you actually, the rubber meets the road, and until you actually start getting one of these requests or receiving an audit from a controller if you're a processor, or receiving a request for information from a supervisory authority, you're not going to know exactly where you stand. And that's unfortunately the case for every new law. And so, you know, it's going to continue to be a learning process.
Absolutely. And my final word on the subject of what we've been discussing is that Beatmaster just pointed out for me in IRC that Rian Johnson is the director of Episode 8 of Star Wars.
So that's good.
That would be.
I was thinking we were going to have to go down through a parody analysis to see if that was copyright infringement, but
yeah, I was about to say that because. If you look at his Twitter feed, you would not be able to tell that he was even involved in Star Wars if you didn't know his name.
Yeah. That's crazy. Love it. Before we go any further, we're going to put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases into the show in case you are watching or listening in hope of getting continuing legal education credit if you're a lawyer, or professional education credit in whatever field you may be involved. So our first phrase is going to be privacy policy polyamory. If you are a lawyer in the United States and want a little bit more information about how to apply for credit in your jurisdiction, head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, and there's a jurisdiction by jurisdiction chart that should provide you with a little bit of help. First phrase, privacy policy polyamory. All right, let us move on. One of the other things that Christian pays lots and lots of attention to, in fact, as I mentioned, he is part of his firm's blockchain technologies team, is everything having to do with blockchain stuff. So let's talk about, we've been talking about regulating privacy. Let's talk about regulating the blockchain, shall we? Another really super fascinating area of technology and the law these days, and another area where, you know, we're very early days and lots of people are scratching their heads about how to deal with, think about, and ultimately regulate blockchain technologies. The SEC has been scratching its head about that, hasn't it, Christian?
It absolutely has. The SEC has, you know, blockchain's been on the radar now for at least a couple of years. And it has been so far very sort of equivocal in the approach that it has taken. And it's been absolutely fascinating to me. If you'd have told me, you know, 5 years ago that we'd be in a world where, you know, by and large, what the SEC has stated are clearly illegally issued securities are trading every day, millions, sometimes billions of dollars on unregulated and unregistered exchanges. I would have said you're nuts. And yet that is exactly what's happening right now.
And we're speaking specifically of initial coin offerings or ICOs, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, initial coin offerings or ICOs, or you know the underlying currencies that existed before you know the ICO was invented, as it were. You know, I mean even, mm-hmm. but I mean Bitcoin, of course, isn't a security. Bitcoin's a commodity. There's been a district court has come out and said that now. But yeah, we're talking primarily about ICOs and we're talking and the listing of those ICOs on exchanges, foreign and domestic exchanges, where they trade hands.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think the SEC is going to do? What are they telegraphing these days?
Well, you know, I think that it's hard to say. I think where they're going to start and where they've sort of signaled where they're going to start is with trading tactics. So it seems like they're focusing most recently on price manipulation, you know, painting the tape. Wash trading, spoofing, these other things that are happening on the exchanges that are fraudulent. And so it looks like they're going to attack maybe that first. They've certainly gone after some low-hanging fruit with some of the smaller operators. But, you know, as for going after maybe the larger folks, it seems they have not as of yet done that. And with the number of ICOs that are out there that are proliferating, you know, every day, it seems like it's becoming a longer and a longer shot that they're going to go, you know, and try to just shut down everything, right? Which is certainly an approach that they could take. Ultimately, I think this is a good thing to take a more measured approach, but I think they really got caught flat-footed, to be honest.
Yeah, it sounds that way. So for those who may not be as familiar with this fundraising mechanism, maybe you should take a step back and describe in a little bit more detail what this phenomenon is.
Sure. So what an ICO really is it is an offering of a coin or a token to the public in exchange for generally other cryptocurrencies that have established value. Mm-hmm. So typically you'll establish a site that will facilitate, you know, and establish a price for your cryptocurrency. You'll introduce a team, and typically you'll have a white paper that describes what the cryptocurrency is going to do. There will then be an opportunity for investors from all around the world, generally speaking, to deposit Bitcoin or Ethereum. Generally, it's Bitcoin or Ethereum or some of the other more stable, more established currencies in exchange for a set number of tokens. Then on the day that the offering goes public, that exchange takes place. And then you hold in your wallet those coins. And mm-hmm. what those coins do, of course, depends on the ICO, depends on the team. Mm-hmm. But it's unique in a couple of ways. It's to be distinguished from something like an accredited offering to investors in the sense that on most occasions there has been no sort of accreditation process. There, in some cases, the identity of the investors isn't even known. And the second sort of unique and I guess desirable feature from a certain standpoint of ICOs is that those coins are then almost always immediately tradable. And very often founders and promoters of ICOs will make considerable efforts to get these coins traded on one or another of the larger exchanges so that there's an immediate market there for the coins and for purchasers and sellers of the coins.
Right. So for the time being, this is just going to continue on. And even though it looks like it should be subject to the securities laws in the U.S. for the time being, mm-hmm. All of the various pretty onerous compliance obligations that are on companies that raise money either by doing private or publicly traded securities, for the time being, these by doing it in the form of a token, you're sort of skirting those requirements, correct?
Yeah, that's what's happening as a practical matter. It's the question is, what happens when and if, you know, the SEC comes knocking at your door. I mean, Chairman Clayton has been very clear in comments that he's made repeatedly that he regards the vast majority of these ICOs to be, you know, basically illegal issuances of stock, of securities. And that most of these tokens are not, quote unquote, utility tokens. They're securities and they're regulated by the SEC and they weren't issued properly. There are some really interesting and I think, you know, I'm not exactly a securities law expert. There's very interesting approaches being taken by some of the better law firms in the country that have analyzed this issue, you know, trying to figure out ways to do these token sales in compliant manner. In a compliant manner with Reg A plus, with, you know, these sort of hybrid Reg D offerings, things of that nature. And those are, you know, hopefully there will be an approach that things consolidate around. But as it stands, yeah, there's just a lot of ICOs out there that have been declared more or less improper by the SEC and are nevertheless trading on a daily basis.
The North American Securities Administrators Association, NASAA, has come out with a statement recently. What do they have to say about it?
Well, what was really interesting about the NASAA statement was the number of resources brought to bear. You know, they talked about it was the North. It's a North American entity. It's not just a U.S. entity. And they talked about international cooperation between Canada and Mexico and the United States. They talked about all of these state regulators that are out there, all of the state securities regulators. And folks often forget that, you know, states do have their own securities laws and they do have their own securities regulators that have been going after some of the more fraudulent, perhaps more egregious ICO promoters, at least to their mind. Typically through cease and desist letters. Also, you know, there's, of course, the inquiry approach that the former New York Attorney General took with respect to the exchanges, which is to send them a letter that says, tell me everything, right? But, you know, what that really underscored for me is the enormous task in front of a regulator that would want to attack this issue, you know, fully, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of these out there now. And many of these, many, especially the large ones, are incredibly well resourced. Block One just completed an ICO that lasted a year and netted them over $1 billion. And they could afford the legal fees to defend themselves. There's no question of it. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what the SEC does in this environment. It can continue to clearly go after smaller entities, but when will it go after a larger entity that it views as having issued an improper ICO?
Is it mostly blockchain using companies that are issuing these? There's nothing to say, you know, Matt's company couldn't, right?
Well, no. I mean, no, not apart from the securities laws. I mean, Overstock tried to do something with an ICO. Kodak famously said, you know, we're going to do some blockchain stuff, and their stock went up like 20% or something like that. there was another company that changed its name or put blockchain in there, and I think their stock went up 200%, and, you know, and trading was suspended, and it went back down. But, you know, no, it doesn't necessarily have to be a blockchain-based company. But here's the thing. I think ultimately you're going to need to make a persuasive case for why. Not only why do you need a token, but why do you need a blockchain, right? What magical, wonderful thing is a blockchain going to do for you, do for your company, that can't be done with an Excel spreadsheet? And if you can't answer that question, you probably have no business doing an ICO.
That's a very nice way to distill it down. Matt has frequently on the show in the past expressed skepticism for needing to have the blockchain in every single aspect of business and life. Do you still feel that way, Matt?
Absolutely. I think that, like, the way you put it is if you don't understand what the difference between Excel sheet and blockchain is, like, you probably shouldn't be thinking about it. And I will say that there's many solutions in between that are much more secure than an Excel spreadsheet too. But I think it's really interesting in terms of, you know, is the token a commodity or a security? Because if the token is the entire asset that has the value, and so if you're basically buying a string of characters that you're able to trade and, you know, build a ledger of who owns that string of characters, then it's really by definition more of a commodity than it is security. And I think the district court got that right there in terms of blockchain. So it you know, and the same thing, you know, you think about it, like gold is a, you know, commodity that's traded all over the world and holds value. And you want to buy gold when you think that the value of your own currency is overvalued.
Right.
So, you know, and that's not regulated by the SEC. At least I don't think so. I'm not a securities expert, but you know, so there's, you know, when you think about assets that are traded daily as commodities that don't fall under the SEC's regulations. And the question really in terms of, you know, should it be regulated is the securities law a good fit? And you know, you got to think about what is required on disclosures that companies have to make to trade securities, and are those a good fit for whether the underlying value of a currency is going to be there? And from my perspective, the underlying value of a currency at this point is all speculative. So I don't know how they're going to differentiate by you telling, you know, you clearly don't want clear fraud. So the SEC's moves to, you know, take away to punish people who are doing clearly fraudulent things, I think is good. But you know, you have to price a value of a cryptocurrency in order to say what's otherwise, you know, other than clear fraud, what's a bad investment essentially. And I don't know how to do that. That's why I'm a skeptic of it. So I think it's a really tough issue for the SEC. And if I was the SEC, I would be staying out of it as much as I could.
Yeah.
I
think, you know, one of the things that the recent spurt of ICOs revealed is that, you know, first, there is a huge appetite for demand. There's a huge appetite for risk among folks all over the world, and not just people who make more than $200,000 or have $1 million in assets. Right. And that's what the accredited investor regs say. They say basically unless you make that much money, or I don't know if it's $200,000 now, it might be more. I don't know. But you got to be, you know, fairly wealthy in order to take these sort of big risks with these real new stage companies and participate in these, you know, these early stage investments. Other than that, you know, trust us and just invest in the stock market with these more established folks, you know, and what the ICOs have shown is that, well, you know, look, a lot of people are very interested in this. And to a certain extent, I think that really does need to be respected. You know, that said, you know, some of the things that are occurring, I think the SEC is smart, at least from an optics standpoint and probably from an enforcement philosophy standpoint, to go after some of the more egregious price manipulations that are occurring on the exchanges. You know, there is stuff going on there that's, you know, pump and dumps and things of that nature that are not appropriate and are costing people, you know, real money. And I think there's absolutely a role for them there. You know, but, you know, I definitely share Matt's, you know, I'm not an economist. So, you know, I should be careful when I talk about these things, when I talk about currencies and value and how things get valued. But I think, you know, part of the value, at least that is attributed to Bitcoin right now, is a little bit like gold. It's Bitcoin is a perfectly deflationary asset in the sense that there are going to be 21 million of them, full stop. That's it. And it can't be changed. And it can't be changed by, you know, a nation state, which is typically what happens, right? I mean, before, you know, currencies, we're kind of trained to think of currency as something that a government issues. And, you know, when a government issues a currency, it's issuing a currency, at least in part, in its interest. And, you know, our Federal Reserve has a dual mandate. It's not just price control. It's employment, too. And what that says is that, you know, we're going to control the value of the dollar to a certain extent to foster employment. Now, that I happen to think is a very good thing. But some people think, look, I want something that I know is going to hold value. I know there's going to be a limited number of them. Bitcoin is that for me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and that I think in part accounts for the price.
So I'll just mention as an aside, your partner, Evan Brown, my former co-host, was in the chat room earlier. I hope he's still watching so that I can just point out, hey, Evan, it's 2018 and we're still talking about Bitcoin. back at the beginning, the very, very early days when, God, we should have bought the stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Evan,
I know. That's why everyone's buying.
Yeah.
Evan made the prediction that we wouldn't be talking about it, I think, by that time the following year. And of course, here we are. We've been talking about the possibilities for making lots of money and or defrauding people out of lots of money because of the frothy excitement about blockchain technologies. Let's look, before we leave the topic, at some of the things that blockchain can actually do that are useful and may be worth all that frothy excitement. So one thing we have in the rundown for this week is a piece in the New York Times that harkens back to what we were discussing at the beginning of the show, managing data, managing privacy concerns. A lot of people's reaction to the Cambridge Analytica revelations have been, hey, this is a job for blockchain. Let's put our data on a network where it is decentralized. It can't be altered or hacked. It can be managed more readily by the actual data subject. I use that term with air quotes around it. I'm not going to try and interpret exactly what that means under the GDPR. But the point of this piece, which is titled "Tech Thinks It Has a Fix for the Problems It Created, Blockchain," is that maybe this is an avenue to make things better on the data management, ownership, and privacy fronts. What do you think about this, Christian?
I certainly like the theory in the sense that I certainly like the idea that, you know, you have data that is stored, encrypted, and accessible and permissioned only by you, sitting somewhere, and then you can kind of dole that out as you see fit. The problem with this the problem with that is it's not exactly different from what we have now, in the sense that I know my email address, my name, and my regular address, right? And I have a tendency to give it to a lot of people, and then they keep it. So, you know, I don't know if it's going to be a perfect solution for, you know, data and identity writ large. I think there are more discrete applications for it. For example, an electronic health record, where it makes a ton of sense. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, for example, it would be, because I go to a number of different providers. I go to hospitals. I go to pharmacies. I was injured in Turkey, and another time, you know, I went to a walk-in clinic on Chicago and State here. All of these people have different medical records for me, and it would be amazing if they could write with my permission to one record that is being maintained on a blockchain in a decentralized basis. That to me is, you know, so for discrete applications, I think it's a great idea. I think it's a little much to ask for just your data and your identity writ large, because once it's out there, once you've published it to somebody, they have it.
Good point. Matt, at the end of this piece, co-author of a book called The Truth Machine, which is about the blockchain, Michael Casey, says, "We're not saying that tomorrow you can flip the switch and a blockchain is going to solve these problems. What's important is how it opens the door to a new way of thinking about the problems we face." Is your answer to him still, we could do this with a spreadsheet, so let's not?
Not with a spreadsheet, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't use it, but like the issues with Cambridge Analytica and the issues with entering your health information is not one of the storage, right? If the story of Cambridge Analytica was that someone hacked into the server and got the information, then we'd be talking about something different, because we'd be talking about something that security protocols that broke down, or, you know, if it was something more like, you know, the big Target data breach or something, you know, maybe blockchain could have helped with that. But we're talking about like protocols that Facebook intentionally set up to be able to share this data. And they just didn't manage their protocols that well. So like that can happen on the blockchain. There's, you know, unless you set up, you can set up the protocols of blockchain so that only you can give out that information. But even if you set up that, if you use the health metaphor about going to the different doctors. Those doctors, when they input your information, they can also take, like, if they enter into the blockchain, they can set up protocols that they're also storing that information on their own blockchain about you. So it's not a, it's just not a panacea. It's about the protocols you put into place. And I don't think that that, like, so it's still about the people who are running these systems putting in the right protocols to store the data correctly, way more than it is a technical issue. I do think there, you know, there's obviously long-term security things that are better about blockchain. And maybe, you know, maybe if this opens up thought for, you know, what protocols are we putting in place, that's the answer. But we could be having those thoughts anyways. So I that's why I don't know why blockchain, like, changes the game here.
Yeah, I think it's a natural sort of the concept of decentralization is very powerful in the abstract, and I think it's a natural sort of thing to say, well, clearly we can't trust Facebook, clearly we can't trust X, clearly we can't trust Y with our data. So wouldn't it be great if it was all decentralized and just out there and we didn't have to trust anybody but ourselves? But that's unfortunately not the reality. Blockchain or no blockchain, blockchain is just a data, a ledger solution, really, you know, in the final analysis. And ultimately, you're trusting whoever you're sending your data to. You might have more control over the terms under which, or the context in which it's sent, the terms under which it's sent, but ultimately, you're still lodging that trust.
Yeah, and the logical implication of Bitcoin is not necessarily decentralization. You're talking about a ledger that you're writing to that's storing data and ensuring it across other ledgers. It's just as easy to build that and easier to build that. And you look at the cost of, you know, operating the Bitcoin ledger, it's astronomical in, you know, all the energy usage because every computer has to verify that same transaction that's on the network. So that is a huge cost there, but Bitcoin as a technology doesn't require that. And like, logically, like, governments are going to put this on a centralized, the verification process is going to be there, but you're still going to have someone who has access to it. And so, you know, I think that there's this myth that blockchain necessarily has to be decentralized, but I don't see why it has to be. And I think that, like, when you see governments who are putting in blockchains, they're not doing it because it's a decentralized ledger. They're putting it together because they have access to the data.
No, yeah, I definitely. I mean, Bitcoin is a special case. I mean, Bitcoin is so expensive because so many miners are running computations because difficulty is so high because so many people want Bitcoin, and the protocol, you know, under which new blocks get issued was written when in 2009, when, you know, it was like 50 people with laptops who are all billionaires now, if they kept them. I absolutely agree that there is no reason under most circumstances, 90-95% of circumstances, there's no reason to broadcast a blockchain under a proof of work algorithm to the world. It doesn't make sense. You know, there are certain, in my view, there are certain key sort of underlying conditions that merit, you know, the entertainment of the idea of a blockchain. And one of those is, you know, you have a bunch of parties that don't necessarily trust each other. But you don't necessarily, just because you want to do something with a blockchain application, have to broadcast it to the world and then subject it to proof of work. There are lots of other solutions out there, permissioned solutions, different consensus algorithms like Gossip Network or sharding and so on, that can make things a lot more efficient.
In IRC, Beatmaster has pointed out that if you crafted an AI out of blockchain, that would be just nothing but investor gold.
Well, I read an article
of big data.
Yeah, I read an article a long time ago that you know, the AI takeover of the world, that blockchain would power the AI takeover of the world because because our first reaction to an AI takeover would be to turn it off, and blockchain and the blockchain can't really be turned off.
Yes.
So maybe we'll have proven too much there, but it's certainly a very interesting idea.
All right. The other thing I wanted to touch on that blockchain can do is the smart contract. And in fact, that's sort of underlying a lot of what we've been discussing here. If you're going to, for example, be in control of your old data, your own data, by having it on the blockchain and having various specific arrangements with third parties as to what they can do with your data, that's executed by a blockchain-based smart contract. So I just kind of wanted to get your take your temperature, Christian, on, you know, the state of the union as to smart contracts right now. We have a piece in the rundown that says blockchain smart contracts are neither smart nor contracts. Where do things stand?
I think that's right. Blockchain smart contracts are neither smart nor contracts. You know, the killer application of Bitcoin has been the storage of value, and the killer application of Ethereum has been that one smart contract that allows for ICOs to take place. And what we described earlier, where, you know, you put in Ethereum or Bitcoin and you get out a new token, is kind of an example of a smart contract. Mm-hmm. But smart contracts, I think the closest analogy that we would have in American law is like the letter of credit. A smart contract is literally a totally equityless contract, in the sense that it is going to execute or not execute no matter what, depending on what parameters are set. And that sets up some incredibly interesting debates, like what happened with the DAO, with the Ethereum DAO that ultimately resulted in the Ethereum and Ethereum Classic split. Was, you know, they set up this autonomous entity that had code, and some guy figured out, or girl, we don't know who, figured out how to steal a bunch of Ethereum out of this thing. And the question was, is this theft at all, right? Is this theft at all? Because if the code is law and there's no equity, and how they're just applying what the law is as it was written down, that's not a contract that we would recognize at English common law. There's no jurisdiction. There are no equitable terms. There's no judge. There's no mechanism of enforcement apart from the law itself. There's no, you know, doctrines of latches or unconscionability or any of that. So, you know, smart contracts, at least as they're currently sort of thought about, are very limited. Now, you know, Nick Szabo, who's one of the huge thinkers on this, and I think he was thinking about all this stuff back in the early 90s, has this concept of, you know, wet code and dry code, and, you know, what's on the blockchain, and what's an agreement that's in paper between the parties, you know, elsewhere and enforceable somewhere. But, you know, my reaction to that is then you've got to have a really persuasive reason to have the asset transacted on the blockchain in the first place. Why not just use a conventional escrow agent?
Well, I mean, presumably the answer to that someday, when we're better at preventing the code from being exploited in the way that you described, will be because it's more efficient and cheaper. And, you know, I guess I wish I had Mike Arrington on the panel with us so he could talk about buying his condo in the Ukraine and why he thought it was important to do it with a smart contract. I think he would answer, you know, at minimum that it's going to happen and we need to figure out ways that it can happen correctly and well and be a better solution than what we already have. Do you agree with that premise?
I think it's certainly, I agree that the tokenization of assets and specific assets for authenticity purposes is inevitable. And one of the main areas you would see that is like with land deeds. You know, being able to prove that you own something, or, you know, being able to protect what you own from liens or assert liens against what somebody else owns. Like these are sort of core areas that I think a lot of consortia and other folks are exploring. I think it definitely has value in areas where, you know, you're uncertain of the application of law. But, you know, keep in mind that some Ukrainian court would probably have to recognize that that was a valid agreement and that transfer was valid on a blockchain. And while I'm confident that that he looked at this. I mean, there are other jurisdictions that would probably not recognize that. Mm-hmm. So I think you can do things and you can make things more efficient with blockchain in this area, but you still do have to work within the jurisdiction in which you find yourself and think really hard, long and hard about whether this agreement's ultimately going to be enforceable and whether you can enforce it.
Matt, I guess the other reason that I am optimistic about smart contracts and their future, not that they are ready for prime time now, is they have the potential to address something that we talk about on the show a lot and we've talked about on this episode of the show, the fact that legal arrangements between parties are complicated to the point where they can actually be incorporated into an app and put you to sleep, or at least into a deep meditative state. And that in a world where people don't pay attention to those terms, and yet the terms matter a whole lot, maybe having self-executing contracts on a blockchain with the proper parameters in place is a good way of addressing that problem. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, so I think the coolest technology I've seen in terms of, how do you understand what a contract means is that in some merger and acquisitions, legal tech, what they're doing is, when you're doing an M&A transaction, you have to bring in just boxes and boxes of information. And if it's online, you have two problems. One is that you have to sort through all the information, and two, you have version control issues. So every time you update your software, the contract that you sign looks different than the contract that you're reading later on. And so that's one issue that is a real issue in terms of big companies in what they need to do to prepare for merger and acquisition or bankruptcy or anything like that. The other is that, like, using AI is probably the better solution of, what is this? How does this contract mean? How am I able to sort through all of the provisions in contracts? And you think about, like, scaling a company, like, you're going to have contracts here, contracts there, contracts there. Like, you got to have dates, you got to have times, you got to have all of this tracked. And so, like, the solution that's more interesting to me than a quote unquote self executing contract that scares me. I don't know why I'd want that. It's one that kind of tracks the data and keeps the versions intact. Is one that seems more beneficial than and so the ledger can help you do that, right? So a distributed ledger could be the core principle that you're looking at for the underlying data. You can build protocols around it to track the time that you have this write that comes up in July and then you have another write in September. So those things and really thinking about contracts, they amass and you have lots and lots of terms with lots and lots of different parties, and keeping that all sorted out seems like a great thing that smart contracts can do.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with that. Any final thoughts, Christian?
On blockchain, I think it's unfortunately quite a lot like GDPR. It's so early. Even though the Nakamoto's paper is we're nearing, the 10-year anniversary. It's so early, and I think that's what makes it so exciting and what also makes it so uncertain. But I hear a lot of people analogizing, where we are in blockchain to the internet in 1995, and I'm not even sure we're that far along. So we'll see.
Yep, that's crazy. Absolutely. It's only been 10 years.
It really is. It really is. In a lot of ways, it feels like it's only been three that it's really become sort of a mainstream idea. And people have, talked about it. My parents are asking me about this, and hopefully as it sees more adoption, hopefully as companies sort of, really start to at least examine whether there's value there, we're going to see new and exciting things that we'd never thought of, and that we're not thinking about right now.
We'll go ahead and give you our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. It is going to be neither smart nor contracts. So if you are watching or listening for continuing legal education credit or other professional credit in your field, go ahead and write this down. There was another one earlier in the show. We put these phrases in case you need to demonstrate to your oversight body that you actually did watch or listen to the show and didn't just write it down on a list somewhere. So our second phrase is neither smart nor contract. All right. Well, one thing I'm sure that people didn't think of when they went heavy into buying their Amazon voice-enabled assistants, is that perhaps one day their conversation would not only be recorded, but then sent on to someone in their contacts. That actually happened. Let's talk about it. So there is a woman in Portland, Oregon, who had an Amazon device in her house, like many of us do. I have one in the room with me right now, which is why I'm careful not to say the E word, which is what triggers it. It actually got triggered earlier in the show today by a word that must have sounded like the E word. And it chimed in to tell us it didn't know the answer to whatever we were talking about the GDPR. So we're not alone, guys. Amazon apparently, or its AI that runs its Echo devices. it didn't know either. But a similar thing happened to this woman in Portland, Oregon. There was just, you know, ongoing conversation, not with the device itself, that appears to have triggered the device not just to record the conversation, but then to send it on to someone who was in her contacts, which, of course, you have the option whether to link your contacts to your device or not, and apparently she had. Amazon told Recode that it thinks this is what happened. The Echo woke up due to a word in the background conversation that sounded like Alexa. Then the subsequent conversation was heard as send a message, at which point the device said out loud to whom, and then the background conversation was interpreted by the device as a name in the person's contact list. And then the device asked out loud again the person's name, right? And then the device was making a lot of assumptions here. Mm-hmm. It then interpreted the background conversation as right and sent the message of the recorded, you know, what it interpreted as a message that was asked to be recorded and then sent. I can actually, as convoluted as that sounds, it seems like a likely thing that could happen. If you have these things in your home and you hear them chiming in and talking to you every now and then, you know that they're listening for their wake words and their commands, and they're like a little puppy dog trying to interpret conversation as something that's directed at them. So I guess the overarching point here is it's maybe not, you know, listening to you in as creepy a way as people might want to think, but it is trying to know when you want it to respond, and that we have apparently room to improve in that regard, because things like this can happen. Did you see this, Matt, and what did you think about it?
Yeah, I thought it was, you know, I read it and thought that, okay, I could see all of this happening. I didn't know you could send your conversations, or that there was a way to record your conversations so that you could send them. But I've walked into, I don't have a Skylon or an Echo, but my sister does. And I've heard a number of times that, you know, it's offered to sell me or sell her something when, you know, you say play a song, or, you know, ask what the time is, and it'll mishear you and, you know, happen to offer you to sell you something that they'll ship to you the next day. Which is a great feature, right? A lot of people use it. But it's the same sort of protocols that you're seeing, you know, people buying over voice and, you know, sending your conversation. So, yeah, I think that's something that Amazon's probably not happy that happened, and they're, I would hope that they're working on making sure that you're not sending conversations. Right. So
yeah, I think in this point,
in this
example, it wasn't that the devices are set up to record conversations, or that that's what it thought it was doing. It thought it heard, according to Amazon, the command send message. And then it interpreted the next speech it heard as the message that the person wanted to send.
That seems like it could happen. I mean, the recognition of speech is not perfect. You know, people mumble. I mumble. So I can see that, like, you know, these words are, they sound like record. And you can actually even say, you know, shall I record? and be talking on, in a different conversation. Like, you're just not thinking about this device that's in your office or your room to the degree that you're aware of what it's doing, because it's just natural. It's just like having your phone. Like, you know, you say Google into your Google smartphone, you know, the same thing happens. People don't think about it all the time, though. And so you run into issues there.
Any thoughts about this, Christian?
I think it's amazing. I don't think we should be surprised. It's remarkable what Amazon, what Google, and what these other folks have done with this technology. You know, you've got something that's, you know, a couple hundred bucks or whatever, and it can do so much for you. It's got voice recognition. It's predictive in many ways. In a way, technology's not all the way there yet, it looks like. You know, that certain things can be buttoned up. They're amazing resources, and I think they're going to just become more prevalent in the future. I think, you know, very soon everyone's going to have one of these or two of these. It's also a fascinating competition, because I would imagine that the amount of value attributable to by Amazon or Google to have one of these, to have won that battle for your home and to have, you know, the ability to purchase something immediately is incredibly high. So I think Amazon will very swiftly react to this, and pretty much Mr. Bezos will make sure this never happens again.
Let's hope so. There definitely seems to be room for improvement, and it's got to be a tough nut to crack. It's got to be listening all the time so it can respond, and yet it's a little over eager, it seems. What were you going to say, Matt?
I'm just amazed that it doesn't happen more often. Like, how many people have these? How many, it's astounding how well, you know, these devices have been built. And that's kudos to them.
All right. So last episode, we talked about and listened to some AI generated music. Between then and now, listener Jonathan Annett wrote in with an example of AI-generated art. So we'll go ahead and show you Derek, who is at DataSpective, on Twitter, posted this piece, which I assume he programmed the neural net to generate. It is it looks like a painting. It looks like, here we go. It has the outline of a horse. It has what looks like either Napoleon or some sort of French revolutionary, maybe non-revolutionary, on the horse. Someone in uniform.
You're never sure with the French.
Yes, no. Anyway, it's this really, really interesting piece. There's, you know, sort of bunting in the background. I thought it was really cool. And in the thread after Derek at DataSpective posted this, he responded that it was generated by something on GitHub called neural-style. A neural algorithm of artistic style by Leon A. Gaddis, Alexander Ecker, and Matthias Bethge. The point is to combine various styles of art and allow you to create works that appear to be in those styles. And they're pretty cool. There's a lot of detail on the GitHub page, but I just wanted to point out for our purposes as we wrap up the show today that not only are AIs making music, which is very listenable, but they're also capable of generating art, which is artistic. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the technology is crazy that it's able to create that, and there's arts. I'm certainly not an artist, so I can't really speak to art, but you know, people who are able to put together a piece that's like makes you comfortable, that invigorates you to, you know, some higher form of being, it's incredibly difficult. And like and you can see like great paintings or like great technical paintings that don't elicit that same feeling, even though the technically, you know, they're just as difficult, if not more difficult. So what makes a great piece of art? I'm not certified to say for sure.
No, nor am I. Although I will point out, just as an aside, that another thing I spotted in my sort of carousing around the web in the last couple of days is a technology journalist, I forget who, highlighted a piece of art that was one of those claw machines where you reach in and grab a toy and try and pull it out, although they're nearly impossible. And it was just empty. It was just sitting there empty, and that was the work of art. And I don't know, could an AI generate that?
Art.
Probably.
Yeah.
It's sort of bleak and stark. Christian, any thoughts on AI art?
Well, you know, I think it's so interesting. I think it's interesting and exciting when you see AI doing things that you wouldn't normally associate with computing and with technology. You know, with that sort of technology, it seems like every day we see something new that artificial intelligence is capable of doing. And most of it, you know, I mean, a couple of years ago, right, AI beat the world's best Go players for the first time, and something a lot of people thought was impossible. I mean, if you grew up playing chess like me, you know, computers had us beaten in 96, but it took a long time to win in Go, a long time. And a lot of people thought that was impossible because there were too many possibilities and so on and so forth. And it turns out not. But I think they would have been it's in a way, when you see paintings that kind of make sense or music that makes sense and it's purely AI driven, that's almost in a sense more alarming. Right. Because you just don't even know, I guess you just can't even imagine what sort of computations are going on that would allow that will allow it to even do that or to do it well. It's definitely I found the Napoleon painting especially a little unnerving, I must say. That looks scary to me, I got to tell you. You know, I'm not sure what that is. I got to say.
I know. But you know, I mean, that's in my mind, that's what makes compelling art, right? You want to sit and stare at it and try and figure it out. If you saw that hanging in a museum, you might spend a good amount of time in front of it just trying to take it in.
So you can say pretty unequivocally that a human wouldn't have painted that in the last 10 years, right? I mean, it's not abstract, and in a way it's incredibly abstract. It's interesting, but I still find it scary.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. All right, so to cleanse the palate for anyone out there who is a little bit terrified by the art that we just showed, let's bring you our animal selfie of the week. I'm happy to bring you this week an animal selfie of the purest kind, where the animal seems to have taken the photograph on its own. This was posted by Go Fetch Dog Daycare and Boarding. And this is not the first time that we've found one of these, either whether it's an animal shelter or a daycare. They put up cameras so that everyone can see what the animals are doing at different times and in far-flung regions of the structure. And here, one of the doggies seems to have figured out how to trigger the camera, or maybe just jumped right in front of it. Maybe I'm attributing too much for this dog. But I feel like it's reaching up there and taking this, and it's got quite the crowd of its colleagues around it, and it does look like they're all posing and paying attention. Maybe the camera somehow speaks and got their attention. I really don't know, but it's a great selfie that was posted by Go Fetch Dog Daycare and Boarding. So for your dog appreciation and animal selfie pleasure. Any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, that's a whole lot of dog there.
It is. It looks, and you know, the fact that they're all engaged and involved.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, taking an Ellen selfie with the crowd all around you or what have you.
Yeah.
Looks like maybe they're Ellen fans. Who knows? All right. So
I bet they are.
It even looks like he's holding the camera.
It does.
It really does. So a very worthy contribution entrant into the animal selfie genre. Our resources of the week are twofold. We were just speaking of bots and what they can do. I think I got an email from this bot. It is signed CockyBot, which is the name of the bot that is our resource. The email I received says, "Hello, Denise. Saw your This Week in Law episode 417 with coverage of Marlon Bundo the Bunny Part 2. As a trademark monitoring bot, I recently noticed that the Pences did go and file for a trademark on Marlon Bundo on March 29th. And then it provided the link to where you could see that that trademark had been applied for by the Pence family. What will this mean for little Marlon?" says the email from the purported bot. And it's signed CockyBot. So CockyBot itself is quite an interesting thing. It scans the U.S. patent and trademark, whether or not a human sent me that email, which I'm kind of guessing they might have. It scans the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office's database for recent applications to register trademarks relevant to authors of fiction. It's been described as an advanced warning system on crazy trademarks, but it can double as a fun way to discover creatively titled new book series, etc. So CockyBot is kind of a neat thing if you're into trademarks and crazy trademarks. You know, we have various blogs and things that monitor crazy patent applications. So CockyBot seems to be doing a yeoman's job and possibly a human's job, what would otherwise be a human's job, of culling through the trademark applications and finding interesting / crazy new ones. So check out CockyBot if you're interested in more of that. And then another thing that we discussed on the show today is code is law in the context of smart contracts. Of course, that concept emanates from The Laws of Cyberspace by Professor Lawrence Lessig. And we were talking about 10 years on into the world of Bitcoin. We are 20 years on into The Laws of Cyberspace, Lawrence Lessig's groundbreaking paper on that topic. So very cool. That was published in 1998. And in its honor, Harvard Law has a little write-up on it talking about reflecting on the two decades since the publication of The Laws of Cyberspace, as they write, which, in the words of Professor Jonathan Zittrain, imposed some structure over the creative chaos of what maybe was a field that we'd all call cyber law. Just wanted to point out that that had happened. Can you believe it's been 20 years, Christian?
I cannot believe it's been 20 years. So much has changed. And some things have stayed the same, you know. But it is an area that has definitely evolved, but I think from a legal perspective, but I think that the technology has evolved faster than the law. And this continues mm-hmm. to be the case. It's the case in many industries because the law is a slow moving entity in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, take the example of whether a coin is a security. You're applying the Howey test from 1948, right? Or 46, whenever it was decided. So, right. You know, the law is a slow moving entity, but I can't believe it's been 20 years, and I'm very eager to see what the next 20 bring.
Yes. Excellent point. Matt, what do you think? What were you up to 20 years ago when this was published?
Oh, gosh. I was running around in the farm I grew up on. So that's what I was doing. I think we had like a DOS computer at that point. So, I think that, we brought up, you know, rules of equity and that sort of thing, and that's, you know, that's in conflict with code is law. So it's an interesting balance as we try to deal, you know, code is law is a very efficient thing, but equity steps in to sort of get a framework of where efficiencies have their bounds, and so it's just an interesting balance that we'll continue to work with.
It is indeed. And one thing that even though we've come a long way technologically and it tends to keep outstripping the law's ability to keep up with it, it's certainly continually outstrips people's ability to use it wisely and in a considered manner. We've had a couple of good examples of that this week. Our tip of the week this week, as it has been many times in the past, is to be very aware of what you are committing to writing and the world in your social media accounts and the way in which you're doing it, because it can definitely jeopardize your job. We have been covering people losing their jobs over social media, I think, since the inception of our show in 2006. Of course, this week, Roseanne Barr lost her highly rated, very successful ABC television show because she very stupidly and crassly used her Twitter account. And you know, these consequences are real and will come back to haunt people. And I guess the sort of sub tip under this, not just, you know, what you do on social media can harm you in the employment realm, but a lot of people, tend to think that they are, that their free speech rights are implicated, in this kind of situation. And what we like to remind people over and over again whenever we can is that the First Amendment doesn't work that way. We were talking a bit before the show about if you're an employer, if your employer is somehow part of the government, then things are a little bit more protective for you as a speaker. We were talking about a professor at a college who took some acts that could have been interpreted as speech. And if that's a publicly funded entity, then perhaps there are more protections to that person's job. But here we're talking about ABC, and they are in no way, shape, or form affiliated with the government. First Amendment freedom of speech is not something that has to be afforded by ABC to its employees. And so it was well within its legal parameters to cancel the show and disaffiliate itself with Roseanne Barr. The other interesting Twitter-related episode this week, it's sort of a similar situation. And if you're not a sports aficionado, you might not have heard about it. But there is a basketball executive with the Philadelphia 76ers named Brian Colangelo, who had what the Chicago Tribune euphemistically calls burner Twitter accounts, pseudonymous Twitter accounts, where this individual, Brian Colangelo, was not, at face value affiliated with those accounts, but they were in fact his accounts. And he is now under investigation by the team into allegations that he was using these accounts to do things that, if he was doing them in his own name, could have gotten him fired. So, again, just part of our tip of the week that, you know, using social media in silly ways can get you fired. Any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, especially you can trace back who, you know, you're going to provide enough content that you're probably going to be able to be traced. Remember, James Comey had his Twitter account. I don't know if that was ever verified, but it's pretty clear that it was his.
Yeah.
And he was just, you know, basically just hanging out, you know, he was following his family and friends and like, it, you know, nothing nefarious, but people found out, especially
right.
if you're a big name.
Did James Comey ever cop to it and say, yeah, that's me? I don't think he ever did. But,
I think
the evidence was pretty darn clear that it was him.
Yeah. So, like, I'm sure it was the same in the 18th century when people were writing anonymously. You know, people eventually figured out who they were, at least in some cases. So you got to be aware that that's a risk.
Mm-hmm. Christian, anything you want to add?
I would add that, you know, even apart from the First Amendment implications of this, what a bizarre story about that executive, that he would see the need to tweet this sort of stuff out in the first instance. But yeah, I just have to second what you said. The First Amendment protects your right to say whatever you want, but it doesn't protect your right to suffer the consequences of that action. Mm-hmm. And It's so, you know, if you're going to be an idiot on Twitter, you're going to unfortunately have to pay the price. And there's a constitutional amendment for that.
Absolutely. All right. Well, this has been a wide ranging and really fascinating discussion with Christian Audie, our guest today. So nice to meet you, Christian. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Very nice to meet you, too. Thank you so much.
Let us know before we sign off today if there's anything going on with your practice, anything with your firm, anything you'd like people to pay attention to, your blog that they should read, even though it was updated not that recently.
No, not that recently, but there's going to be another really terrific entry very, very soon. I've been GDPRing it for the last few weeks, especially. But now that we're into the enforcement period, I do blog at distributedcounsel.com. You speak with some regularity. And if you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, it's just my name. But thank you again to both of you very much for the opportunity to be here today. I really enjoyed it.
Been super fun. I've really appreciated your insights and thoughts, and it's great to see you, Matt.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks for coming on, this is fun. And sorry I was late again.
Oh, that's okay. We understand. Busy, but we're really thrilled you can make the time for us and that you got the chance to join us today. We're really thrilled that all of you have joined us today. We're very glad that you do join us when we record this show. If you like to watch us live, we do so at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That would be 2 o'clock Central time. So if you're moving to the West Coast from Central time, know that you're going to have to be a little earlier to make this week in law actually
start.
If
only I had a smart contract to tell me when I was supposed to, you know,
there
start
you
reading.
Go. There
or
you
a Google
go.
Calendar that automatically That's, changes yeah. or something like that.
Yeah.
Yep, that just boots up Skype for you at the appropriate time. I like this idea. Anyway, if you do join us live, that's when we record. But don't worry if you can't join us live, because the shows all get put up at twit.tv/twill, and you can enjoy them. Hopefully you are not using them as a meditation app. Although, you know, however you are using the show, I certainly can't complain, as long as you're tuning in and using the various platforms on which you can enjoy the show, whether it's audio only or video on your phone or a TV, mobile device, living room device, however, whenever. We're thrilled that you can join us on your own time or on ours. We just love having the participation of our audience. It really makes this show very worthwhile to do. And that said, we love hearing from you between the shows. You can email me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Matt is mattc at twit.tv. Mike Keyes, who's not here with us this week, is Mike at twit.tv. So shoot us an email. Let us know what's on your mind about what we discussed. Your thoughts following up on what we discussed, your thoughts about art or music or entertainment that we should be paying attention to, your thoughts about things that you've read that you'd like us to pay attention to, and folks that you think would be good guests for the show. All of those things and anything else that's on your mind. We just love hearing from you between the shows. So do get in touch in your social media consumption. I'm D Howell on Twitter. So if you at me there, that's a great way to just let me know that you've spotted something that you think I should see and pay attention to. Definitely appreciate that as well. So we also have a Facebook page. We're This Week in Law there. We have a Google Plus page still to this day, but I got to be honest, I'm really not monitoring that anymore. So if you're going to ping me on Google Plus, I'm going to see the notification in my email and I'm going to go, oh, how cute. Someone is still using Google Plus, and I'll go over there and I'll give you a plus one. How about that?
It seems like the Google Plus has the right to be forgotten, like down pat.
They have like their own right. Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly. They nailed that one.
they did. And I'm sad because I always really liked that platform and think it has a lot of potential. So maybe it will have a renaissance. Who knows? If you are part of that renaissance, we do have a page over there and I'm on it too. So, you know, I don't care how you get in touch with us. Just please do so. And let us know your thoughts. We really enjoy that. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Until then, please take care.